Chapter 11, Herman the German and the Pullout Couch. That night I went home and told Franny that I had messed up. Franny said, "Okay, listen. You've spent most of your life as a comedian. When you said something, all that mattered was, is it funny? Now you're in a totally different situation. Before you open your mouth, you have to ask yourself three questions." "Okay," I said, "I'm listening." "First, is it true?" "Of course," I insist. "That's my thing. That's what I do." Franny nodded. "I know, honey." "Okay. Second, is it necessary?" "Uh-huh. Like what I did today with Eric Black wasn't necessary." "Nope." "Okay," I asked. What's the third thing?" "Is it strategic?" "And the thing today wasn't strategic." "Doesn't sound like it." I knew, of course, that Franny was right. I'd always thought that I could make a seamless transition from comedian to satirist to activist to candidate to senator, and then someday, at long last, host of Weekend Update. And some things did come easily. For instance, I'd always been something of a wonk and had followed politics and public policy all my life, so learning about the issues, counter-cyclical payments on agricultural commodities, workforce training programs, the importance of the 148th Fighter Wing to Duluth's economy, was something I enjoyed. But I would also have to learn a set of weird and occasionally sociopathic politician skills. For example, you may be familiar with the phenomenon of trackers. A tracker is someone who works for your opponent's campaign and follows you around with a video camera waiting for you to do something or say something incredibly damaging, like telling a baby you're going to raise its taxes or pushing an elderly constituent to the ground. Republicans had started tracking me early before I had even announced, and right away my driver body man, a tall, self-effacing 23-year-old from Moorhead, Minnesota, Chris Dahl, had come up with a plan. Every time we got out of the car, we'd pretend we were in mid-conversation. Chris would emerge from the driver's side first. Stepping out of the passenger side, I'd say, "Chris, I don't know why you don't just buy the pull-out couch." "They're uncomfortable," he'd explain. "They used to be, but new technology has changed everything. The pull-out couch people have made some huge advances in recent years. Go to a showroom," I'd tell Chris, pretending I didn't notice the college kid walking backwards 4 feet in front of me, holding a video camera. "I don't know," Chris would say, clearly racked with indecisiveness. "Chris, you don't need a two-bedroom apartment," I would yell as the tracker stumbled on the curb, barely maintaining both his balance and his grip on the camera. "I'm telling you, man, the pull-out couch will pay for itself in 6 months." Chris and I would have this exact conversation, or a slight variation. "Have you even gone to a showroom yet?" Every time the tracker taped us getting out of the car. My fervent hope is that some Republican staffer had to spend 2 years of his or her precious life transcribing hundreds of hours of me trying to persuade Chris Dahl to get a pull-out couch, and that he or she is still wondering whether Chris ever ended up getting one. Well, good news, he did. No, he didn't. There was never any pull-out couch. So I figured out that one. What I didn't get much better at was remembering people's names. Some politicians, like Bill Clinton, are famously good at meeting someone once and then magically recalling their name when they meet 3 years later in an entirely different context, even if the other guy has lost 150 pounds. Hubert Humphrey was like that, and so was Bernie Madoff. But most of us aren't. Now, here's a tip. If you want to get an office holder to dislike you, go up to him or her and say, "I bet you don't remember my name." This is why the most important items at fundraisers are name tags. I've gotten very good at turning to speak to someone, my eyes sweeping diagonally over their chest on the way up to their face and saying, "Hey, Dennis, it's great to see you." Trouble remembering names is a wonderful bonding subject for U.S. senators and their spouses. In our first term, Franny and I had a semi-regular dinner with three other couples, Diana and Mike Enzi, Republican of Wyoming, Jill and Tom Udall, Democrat of New Mexico, and Stephanie and Mike Johans, Republican of Nebraska. It took me 5 dinners just to remember all of their names. And Mike Enzi still calls me Arnie now and then. I happen to love Stephanie Johans because she has the best laugh, and even better, she laughs at almost anything I say. But one evening, Stephanie made all of us howl with laughter. We were discussing our most awkward moments, blanking on the names of constituents. Stephanie painted a picture of a typical political event back in rural Nebraska with folks milling around, chatting, and having a great time. Stephanie said she was talking to a small group and then turned around and saw a woman whom she knew but couldn't place. Stephanie said, I knew this woman, and I panicked. Then I figured out who she was and said, oh, hi, Mom. Probably the most ridiculous politician skill I had to learn, though, was how to pivot, a term which basically means not answer questions. For example, say a reporter asked me, in latest polls, you trail Norm Coleman by 20 points. How can you get DFLers to support you for the endorsement if you're so far behind? My instinct would be to answer the question. But that's not what you're supposed to do. You're supposed to say, when I go around our state, Minnesotans don't talk about polls. They talk about their kids' education and how they're worried that they'll go bankrupt if someone in their family gets sick, and so on. I understood the concept, but for some reason I was unable to use it. I had always been taught by my parents and my teachers to answer questions directly and completely, which I did for the first 10 months of my race, driving my team nuts. But of course, my team was right. Reporters would just use the most interesting and usually unhelpful sound bites in my lengthy responses to their questions instead of writing about the message that we wanted to get out that particular day. Take, for example, the Herman the German incident. New Ulm, a beautiful small city in south-central Minnesota, was founded by German immigrants in the mid-19th century. It boasts an enormous monument to Arminius, the Germanic warrior who led the slaughter of 12,000 to 15,000 Roman soldiers in the Battle of Teutoburg Forest in 9 AD, when Jesus was just a kid. Locals call the 27-foot statue Herman the German. Herman stands upon a 70-foot base, so I was literally speaking in Herman's shadow while addressing a small crowd one fall afternoon in 2007. Now, you should understand that I grew up in St. Louis Park, known statewide as the Jewish suburb of Minneapolis. So here's the situation. I'm a Jew. I grew up in St. Louis Park. I'm in New Ulm, standing in the shadow of a massive monument to Herman the German. And I'd been in comedy for 35 years. So what immediately occurred to me was, now, I grew up in St. Louis Park, and we had a much smaller statue than Herman the German here. Ours was called Stu the Jew. But I didn't. I didn't say it. There was a tracker there, and in the nanosecond that I made the decision not to go with Stu the Jew, I imagine that put through the dehumorizer, Republicans could use the video to intimate that somehow I was blaming the good people of New Ulm for the Holocaust. And then it would get written up not as Coleman takes hilarious Franken joke way, way ridiculously out of context, but as Republicans slam Franken for blaming Holocaust on New Ulm. So instead, I bit the inside of my cheek and talked about universal health care, climate change, and Norm Coleman's dismal record in the Senate. I was on message. And as we walked back to the car that day, Chris, resuming the conversation about his pull-out couch. Come on, I'd have to drag it up all those stairs. I knew that what he was really saying was that he and the rest of the team were proud of me. But a few weeks later, a writer from New York Magazine came to Minnesota to follow me around and do a story on my campaign. At one point, the writer asked me, do you ever think of something funny and decide not to say it? Sure, I answered. For example, she asked. I then recounted the Stu the Jew story because, you see, she had asked me for an example, and of course, Stu the Jew appeared prominently in the article. Reading the Stew the Jew story in New York Magazine was a turning point. Why did I do that? I thought to myself, immediately after Jess and Andy had asked me, why did you do that? My team pointed out that a perfectly good response to, for example, would have been, gee, I can't think of one offhand. And then pivot by saying, but you know what isn't a joke? The fact that so many healthcare crises lead to bankruptcies. It was a learning moment, unlike the many previous potential learning moments from which I could have learned but didn't. So I sat down with Jess and did yet another practice session on pivoting, and this time I was determined to get it right. A couple days later, I had a sit-down interview with a Minnesota print reporter who had interviewed me a number of times before. I have no recollection of the actual content of the interview, but I distinctly remember the thrill of using a new skill. Right out of the box, I pivoted to avoid answering a perfectly valid question so I could instead talk about whatever it was I was supposed to talk about that day. And the reporter seemed just fine with it. So I did it again on the second question. Again, the reporter seemed to have absolutely no problem. On the next question, just for the hell of it, I really overdid it, pivoting gratuitously. Again, I completely got away with it. The rest of the interview involved a series of egregious pivots, followed by my hammering home some point or other. When the interview ended, the veteran reporter turned to Jess and Andy. Hey, he's getting a lot better, he said with a smile. I think he's got a real shot.